Hello and welcome to the Rogue Economy episode of the FinTech Newscast. This week we'll be looking at countries and actors that are outside and in some very creative ways getting around the formal international banking and finance system. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news.
Have you been reading about this Polar Vortex business? I mean, I know the name is really overdone, but...
Yeah, it's pretty scary. My mom...
I almost had to wear a jacket today.
Yeah. My mom sent me a screenshot of the weather forecast that she was looking at on the TV. Four degrees today and tomorrow in New York. Super exciting.
Hello and welcome to the Rogue Economy episode. With me this week is Steve.
Hi, everyone.
And Monica.
Great to be here.
All right, let's start with everyone's favorite rogue economy, Venezuela.
Right, so Venezuela has been in the news for the past few weeks for a good reason. There's a lot of political turmoil. They held an election sometime last year in which Maduro, amidst a bunch of irregularities, claimed to be the elected president of the country. However, as we record this in late January, about a week ago, a gentleman by the name of Juan Guaido, I think, who is the opposition leader, claimed to be the rightful president of the country. So fast forward, of course, Trump gets involved. There's a lot of calls to action from the Chinese and the Russians, but there's sort of a power struggle in the country now. But so we thought that it would be really interesting to look at, to kind of look at the background of the Venezuelan economy, how they got to this very desperate state they're in now, and also understand sort of what they're looking at or what their strategies would be in either the fintech space or cryptocurrencies.
Well, one thing that I noticed was that the powers are already looking at ways they can challenge each other, like Putin saying that the U.S. should stay out, and the U.S. taking sides, and everybody trying to make it about their positions.
It is. It's interesting. This is one. So I'm a bit of a poli-sci nerd. My undergrad BA is in poli-sci, and this having Russia and China sort of interfere in the states of Venezuela would be a breakage of the Monroe Doctrine, right, from 200 years ago, where basically the U.S. saw all of Latin America as its backyard, and it would impede any sort of...
European.
And any European or any other country some kind of taking any active role in the region, the same way that Russia would have what they call their near sphere of influence, or the near abroad, rather, which would be like the Caucasus. So if, you know, now either because of this presidency or whatever, we have a situation where a lot of European players are trying to mandate how we should relate to our neighbors, which is kind of a massive change in the way that we relate to, again, our neighbors in South America.
And certainly the U.S. has not historically been shy about intervening in the political regimes and turmoils of different countries in Latin America. And in certain respects, we've been quite hands-off with this very terrible humanitarian disaster that's been going on in Venezuela for decades now. And it's just kind of interesting that all of a sudden it seems even of more geopolitical interest to some of our other, I think foes is too strong a word, but some of our co-competitors.
Right, and to put some more context on that, I understand that in 1998, Venezuela was the richest country in South America, which is pretty incredible when you look at what's happening now. And they have their inflation, I think hits 200,000% this, or last year rather. And they have something like 2 million people have fled the country to either neighboring countries, Colombia, Brazil,
and
Peru.
And that's huge. It's not a big country.
It's about 10% of their population has left the country to go.
It's like 30-some million Americans leaving.
Exactly, yeah.
And I don't think we can even really get a good conception of what the drop in living standards has been like for the Venezuelans who still remain.
Right.
Like, they have gone from all of the trappings of a normal functioning society to operating rooms that can't run the lights, much less can pay their doctors or have clean hypodermics.
Yep.
Like, those things are not available in the country anymore because of this economic crisis that has just been going on and on. Thank you so much, Maduro and Chavez.
Right, right. Yeah. Food shortages, just, yeah.
So what led to all this? How did that happen so quickly?
Yeah, so a little bit about it is that under the presidency of Hugo Chavez a couple of years ago, they really expanded their social safety, which is, I think we'll agree, sort of a net good. But I think that they did it in a way where they use their oil reserves and their oil economy to kind of prop up the regime by basically handing out a ton of free money for people.
It's not like oil is going to go under $100 a barrel anytime soon.
They've mismanaged their state-run oil company. They've kind of used it as a piggy bank. They're just printing money and just...
Well, the corruption and theft.
The corruption as well. Theft is an issue. But a lot of the mismanagement of the country has led to this state they're in now, which is just... untenable for so many people that again so many have left. So in the midst of all this chaos and uncertainty and economic issues, Venezuela is like many other people across the world embracing cryptocurrencies now. So they've announced and have launched what they call a Petro crypto coin, which is kind of interesting.
The Petro, what do they call it?
Yeah, it's the Petro, but it's kind of an interesting use case for cryptocurrency, and it kind of flies in the face of anything that you think of when you think of like Bitcoin. So back in January of 2018, they announced that the Petro was going to be launched, but get this, it would actually be tied to the Bolivar, which as we know is a very devalued currency. And kind of, again, you know, it's you typically think of cryptocurrencies as being... user-generated, free-floating, no state regulation as to what their value should be. But now the one, independent,
free from control,
absolutely transparent.
And they're doing everything the opposite of that.
They're doing the opposite of that. They're launching a Petro that will be tied to the Bolivar, or they did rather last year, which again is kind of a weird use case for cryptocurrencies. And then in August of 2018 or last year, they also announced that the Petro would be used. As a measure of account for things like salaries and goods and services.
But it still has all the same volatility as the rapidly inflating currency?
Correct.
So it doesn't... Well, is it just for the hype? Just for window dressing? What does it actually... How does it actually benefit then?
I don't feel like Maduro has ever actually really tried to solve a problem for normal Venezuelans, so why would he start with his cryptocurrency?
Right, exactly, yeah.
So
yeah.
Just for show, then, this is...
Well, I think a lot of it is
just... You can't just mine independently. You have to get a license or a permit.
You have to go in person to some ministry in Caracas and get a permit to be able to mine this currency and take part in it, yeah. It's all topsy-turvy.
But if you're a civil servant, are you compelled to take your payment in it?
That's what they announced last year in August of 2018 is that you have to be paid now in Petros, which are tied to the currency there.
So you work for free.
So you basically work for free, yeah, which I think is in line.
To be fair, we've been asking our state employees to do too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, glass houses, stones, and all that. Also, kind of interesting. As of last year, in December of last year, they also announced that all the pensioners' bonuses and payments would be distributed in Petros as well, so that they really want to spur adoption of this cryptocurrency. So if you have a pension in Venezuela and you get your whatever monthly stipend, it'll be paid out in Petros, not in Bolivars.
So really the only benefit is that you don't have to keep track of a lot of pieces of paper with the Petro.
Right. You can use the Petro as confetti, you know. I think I mentioned
toilet paper
or TV, exactly. Yeah.
It only runs though on the Venezuelan operating system,
right,
that they're coming out with. So
yeah, and there's actually so it is a currency. It is out there. We can actually track it. I know that if you go to CoinMarketCap, you can see the fluctuations of the Petro. And I'll give you two guesses here. How much do you think a Petro is worth right now?
Per dollar?
Per dollar, yeah.
Okay. For US dollar, it's 10 zeros and a 1.
10 zeros and a 1. Pretty close. It's actually $0.014 per Petro.
0.014. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, it's if you want to put that in Bitcoin perspective, it's 0.00004 Bitcoin.
Ugh. Oh, okay. Now I understand.
Now it makes
Bitcoin
sense. Yes,
actually.
Yes.
So
we only think of Bitcoin. Yeah. Yeah.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. But it'll be interesting to see how the country, how you can have a state mandated cryptocurrency. This has never happened before because it's sort of counterintuitive to the whole concept of crypto. but how they will use this and what the implications of this will be for other economies that may be sort of on the in the roguish arena, if you will, or maybe outside of the major
well
systems.
It's also, you know, I guess a theoretically interesting way to deal with a currency crisis, which, you know, will always happen again in some other country. I look at Venezuela and I wonder, like, is this actually the tipping point for them as a nation? You know, you've got, you finally have the rest of the world getting fairly involved. You have a internal opposition leader who is so far not backing down around wanting to get rid of Maduro. And I mean, we're now at a place where it really kind of depends on what their military does, which way it will go in terms of who leads them.
Right.
Where I think the most Petros might have.
Whoever has the biggest mining rigs.
I just think it's interesting. Like, we're talking about the financial aspects of it today, but right now, given where they are at this crisis point, like the political and military balance is probably much more influential on what their future will be.
I wonder whether this will turn into like a Syria where you have a stalemate and sort of an opposition and, you know, it's seen as a proxy war for the major powers, or whether this will be something that can be resolved in the next few weeks.
That would be terrible if more weapons actually came in.
Yeah.
It's going to make it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because there haven't been a lot of military interventions in South America over the past like 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't think that there's been any. And this could be, of course, you know, the first domino to kind of get that started. It's interesting
how... And
it's
never good for your neighbors when those things happen.
No,
either.
Not at all. In terms of like...
And none of those countries can really support sustained refugee
mm-hmm.
streams. You know, they have fragile elements in their economies and societies as well.
Yeah, Colombia is just trying to settle down their situation.
Yeah.
Right, all their internally displaced persons, yeah.
Yeah.
Interestingly, there was a news report, I think, 2 days ago or so in late January, that mentioned that there was a meeting where John Bolton gave some sort of press thing, and on the notepad was written, send 5,000 troops to Colombia. The argument is that this could be sort of him saber-rattling and
something that John Bolton is very good at.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So
with his Mark Twain mustache.
I would say more Yosemite Sam, but yes.
it is quite bushy. Yeah.
It is bushy, yeah. But I wonder, are they trying to actually send troops to Colombia or just send the message that if Maduro and his people don't cede, they see that as an option?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? You know, the one thing that I will give the Trump administration credit for, and this is the one thing that I like about what they're doing, is that they're taking a non-interventionist approach to foreign policy. They haven't gotten us into any new wars, and they're trying to draw down our presence abroad, whether rightly or not, as a American. But at least we're not sending more kids out there.
Yeah, and you know what? Hey, we might be out of NATO before all this is over.
Yeah.
And won't that be great?
Wouldn't that be incredible?
For Russia and China, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, on that happy note, let's move on to another point of contention with the great powers, North Korea.
North Korea, yeah. So also another country in the news recently. So they're also trying to get in the crypto space. They announced, I think in the middle of 2018, a coin called the Koryo coin. I'm not sure whether Korea means Korean in Korean.
Oh,
I don't think it does. I think it's
Hanguk, right.
Like the tires. I think that means Korean in Korea.
Okay.
Yeah.
That means Korea in Korean is Hanguk. But they also, you know, I think they have a more compelling case for getting into cryptocurrencies.
Because they're used to already hacking into countries all over the world and stealing them. So they have a lot of experience.
They have
it's better
the
than hacking a movie studio. Jeez.
Yeah. They seem to have the technical know-how, and they also want, because they're really more ostracized economically than Venezuela, so they have an interest in having high anonymity. They don't want people to track their funds, and they also want easy cash flow. So I read somewhere that North Korea is the largest producer of counterfeit U.S. currency in the world
mm-hmm.
by a mile.
Mm-hmm.
They're really good at it.
Yeah.
They're really, yeah. I'm sure they are. But yeah, they've announced this coin. It's not listed anywhere. I think they want to use it so that whatever tourists they get into the country will be able to buy goods and services with this cryptocurrency thing. So you would have to install a North Korean-produced digital wallet on your phone and then pay for stuff there. That should be interesting.
Also, if you're looking to be a tourist maybe find a place slightly less totalitarian to its citizenry than North Korea.
Yeah. You can go
just to a suggestion from your friendly travel agent, Monica.
Yes.
You can go to Universal Studios and see mocked up cities that look nice as well.
You
they
can.
They just tour you with your minder through these fake, I've seen some of the
it's
interviews.
It's like a Potemkin village.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
Yeah, and that kid who died last year, Otto Warmbier as well.
Yes.
You know, sort of.
Was he a tourist, or did he get caught over the border?
He was in China, and then he was offered a tour of North Korea, and he took it. And I think he took out a poster from the wall, and from that ended up getting this massive.
It was a poster on the wall.
He took a poster that he thought was kind of funny or interesting, and then somehow they caught him.
He's a kid, because kids and people make stupid decisions, and
a picture would be fine.
A picture, yeah.
I'm not even sure you're allowed to take pictures.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Don't bring your phone to Pyongyang if you find yourself in that area. Yeah.
You can get a lot of choreo for it, though.
You probably can. You can get.
They can also probably scrape your phone for as much data as Facebook can.
Yeah. True. Yeah.
From whether you're there or you're here.
Yeah.
So have they released this cryptocurrency yet?
No, they've announced it. They announced the use cases. I don't think they have a white paper yet. You know how even the Venezuelans have a white paper. They haven't released one yet.
Copy and paste.
Come on, dear Kim.
Get on it. But you know they are suspected of being behind a lot of the hacks of all the South Korea or Seoul based crypto exchanges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And could very well be behind some non-South Korean exchange hacks as well.
Absolutely.
Because they know how to do that. They're very good at that.
Yeah, they are good at that.
Nothing else to do there, so.
And also, just another point, another humanitarian disaster. Is there a theme?
Oh, that's been a while, yeah.
Yeah, that's been ongoing.
I saw something where North Koreans already, for decades, been way undernourished, malnourished, and way underweight. But Venezuela, I saw like the average weight is like something like 25 to 30 pounds less than it used to be.
It's a few kilograms lighter.
Yeah. So terrible.
I can't even imagine what, you know, some of the benchmarks for their youngest and most vulnerable citizens are, their children. Like, you know, are they getting what they need? Are they growing? No. I mean, I'm sure they're growing, but you know what I mean.
Right.
They're probably behind, yeah. I think I heard somewhere that North Koreans are shorter than their South Korean neighbors.
By a lot, I think. Yeah, the protein.
You go through a couple of major famines where you end up eating like grass tea as a way to survive in 25 years. You're gonna get a little shorter.
You're gonna get a little shorter.
I prefer bark.
Yeah. They also apparently don't have words for modern things like fax or computer in Koreans. Modern like post 1956 things like fax and
telegraphs
and telegraphs. Yeah, right. They just don't have those words in their lexicon because of their isolation.
Sometimes when somebody escapes and they interview, if they get to South Korea, they interview them, and it's fascinating all the things that they're surprised at. They have no idea. They have no way of accessing information outside of the propaganda. So
right.
Like, oh, you guys are insanely rich here compared to compared to what dear leader has provided for us.
Right.
It's crazy.
And you can't even get a good haircut.
No kidding.
You can't even get a good haircut, yes.
I think, you know, you'd be afraid to make any changes or else might have a little problem. Those scissors might be going the other direction.
You make it disappear.
All right, so North Korea, clearly a rogue economy. What's next on the list?
So the next on the wonderful parade of countries is Iran. So Iran also is under heavy sanctions from both the EU and the US. They essentially cannot play in the international monetary system. And what's a good way to get around that? Create your own cryptocurrency.
It's a theme here. It's been so effective for the first two.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of things that correlate to Iran as well. So we've all seen the Huawei stuff in the news recently.
Mm-hmm.
A big piece of that indictment was the fact that Huawei was charged with providing technology to the Iranians, right? Which is, again, it would violate sanctions because Huawei
apparently they set up a subsidiary,
pretended
it wasn't theirs.
Right. And that's just my cousin or whatever. And then they can sell technology.
That's my cousin's Iranian subsidiary, not mine.
Yeah, that's not my stuff. But they, you know, I think they also have a lot of the same motivations that a North Korea or a Venezuela would have in terms of, like, they want to avoid scrutiny. They want to play outside the traditional system, and they also want to have a way to kind of prop up their economy locally and maybe spur some other things as well.
Also, the government in Iran is one of the largest supporters of terrorism in the world, and cryptocurrency is a great, it's an easier way of shuttling dirty funds around than, you know, backpacks in the back of your Forerunner.
It's untraceable. It's not very transparent, absolutely.
And also, just another country that's not exactly, like, the best to its citizens. Huh, what an interesting theme we have here.
Yeah. Although, I think that unlike North Korea or Venezuela...
So what is the Iran coin called?
I don't think they don't have a name yet, but they definitely claim to have been working on it for the past 2 years.
Okay.
So they're working on their Farsi language white paper. Of course, you have to have a white paper.
Yeah, and you gotta have a name, and like...
You gotta have a name,
Oh, Farsi just has so many, like, beautiful words. Like, you can get a banging name! Come on, Iran!
The Rosewater coin. I don't know. I love Rosewater.
The Khomeini is not known for his marketing.
No. The Khomeini coin.
Yeah, but he just has to approve the name. He doesn't have to come up with it.
Yeah.
Because he just has to approve everything. Because he's just the supreme leader.
Yeah. It's just a theocracy.
One of the things that I think is interesting about Iran's position is that the U.S. has pulled out of some parts of the nuclear containment strategy treaty that we and European countries had with them, but the Europeans stayed in it. So one of the biggest blockers to Iran being more fully in the international banking system is the U.S. government, because most European countries would be like, heck yeah, let's do this. But Iran is still subject to a lot of U.S. sanctions. And it's just really, really difficult to be in the monetary system without touching U.S. dollars at any point along the way, hence the need for crypto.
So the president made an announcement, I think, sometime in late 2018 that there was a draft coming. No idea when it'll drop, but they're going to drop sort of their framework for the currency, presumably within Q1 of this year, Q1 or Q2.
Hmm.
So staying in the neighborhood of Iran, Georgia also has an interesting perspective on cryptocurrencies and mining. So they're not quite as ostracized internationally as Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela, but they're sort of in this liminal space. They're former Soviet Republic that now wants to be a member of the EU, wants to be a part of NATO, and kind of looks more westward than their neighbors.
It's tough to be a tiny country next to Russia.
Yeah. I think they've been invaded by basically every one of their neighbors. So
well,
Iran, and the Russians, they've all kind of taken their piece
of
Georgia.
Yeah, Russia took a piece pretty recently, just within George W's.
Yeah, I think Abkhazia is a region.
South Ossetia is the way I've heard it.
Yeah, there's two. They took a piece of They took two pieces of the country.
Grabby.
I know, grabby Putin, all under Putin, by the way.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Vlast has been in charge there lately, so.
Yeah, it's a good point.
There's no term limits there. Is that not a thing in Russia? Has that ever been a thing in Russia?
Sometimes we just have to hope for heart attacks on horseback.
Yeah.
Oh man. Shirtless man falls from a horse.
That's how you do regime change.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So Georgia, again, not an ostracized state, but also kind of an interesting model for embracing cryptocurrency. So the country has very low energy costs because they do a lot of hydroelectric energy.
Oh.
So,
very green.
Yeah.
Blue.
Very, very green. They also happen to have a not very strong executive power and presidency. So in this absence of power, this vacuum, one company in particular, it's called Bitfury, which I think is Dutch-Ukrainian, they have come into the country and they've set up one of the world's largest Bitcoin mining operations, second only to China. So the combination of a lot of state support, so they get funding to like build all their rigs, they get discounted energy, even though they have cheap energy costs, they get even further discounted energy. And also, there's a lot of talk and rumors about the fact that some government officials in the country have taken a piece of Bitfury and given them access to, again, all this electricity that they can use to mine Bitcoin. So Bitcoin, as we all know, is a very energy-intensive process, right? And sort of like in Iceland, where you have geothermal energy, and Russia, you have, in Georgia, rather, you have hydroelectric energy. And they became, I think last year, the second biggest Bitcoin miner in the world.
Even with the lower price, it doesn't matter that much. I mean, if your energy is almost free, if you're getting subsidized, a $3,000 Bitcoin price is still...
It's still doable,
profitable.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's a combination of the tax incentives that they give the company and the low energy price. And
maybe Georgia's keeping the Bitcoin price up
maybe
as much as it has
maybe
been.
Well, that's
Georgia's,
what I was
going
to say. Like, are we now at a place where, like, the groups that have the lowest marginal cost of mining Bitcoin are the only ones doing it?
Sounds like capitalism, right?
Yeah, but... Yeah.
Competitive advantage.
But...
Comparative advantage.
Are we sure that people really want to buy Bitcoin? I think not as many people want to buy it as they used to.
Before. Yeah. Actually, from my, a callback to my episode last week, I mentioned a podcast episode where they were talking about a Bitcoin miner in Venezuela. And part of the reason why he was successful is because they also have very low energy costs, because the state subsidizes everything, and they also produce a lot of oil. So,
but it's kind of shitty oil.
It's shitty oil, yeah. But
no,
it's still,
it requires a lot of refining. So
right.
It doesn't cost very much, but it takes a lot more energy to get up.
Is it like sandy oil?
I think it's sludgy.
Sludgy oil.
But like, you know, like the Saudis, they got the primo
shit. They got the primo shit.
It's almost ready to go in your
tank. It's truly like light crude, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Interesting.
Huh. Learned it all here.
That's right.
Yeah. So an EU report last year mentioned that... Georgia has the fastest growing electricity consumption per capita in all of Europe and Central Asia since 2009.
What about pollution?
That is nothing to brag about.
Not
at
all.
It's hydroelectric, right. Okay,
yeah,
so.
Right, but they still argue that even though you know, that's not a good goal to strive towards.
Yeah, why spend it on Bitcoin mining? Like, you could conceivably, you know, if we had better battery or electricity transportation options, they could sell it to their neighbors, you know?
Right.
Or maybe they could do something that would, like, actually raise the living standards of their citizenry. But unlike most of the countries we've discussed here, nobody really seems to be interested in that.
Yeah, so we won't get into it in this episode, but there's a lot of really good stuff about this company, Bitfury, and how they've sort of ingratiated themselves with the leadership in Georgia, again, gotten all these tax exemptions, and have become this massive mining operation.
And I'm sure they're going to stick around when the price of Bitcoin falls again. I'm sure they're long hauling it with their Georgian partners.
No doubts about that. They're in it for the long run.
I love their name. It sounds like a Bond villain.
Bitfury.
Mr. Bond. Bitfury. I'm not going to look while I put you in this torture device.
Or it could have been like a game, like when Bitcoin was super, super hot, like a game you'd park your 6-year-old in front of to teach them how to mine.
Right. The last piece on this is that there's been recent allegations that the former prime minister, Betzina Ivanishvili, is linked to an investment fund that also funded Bitfury, so he has a personal stake.
I'm shocked.
In having the company succeed, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
oh,
shocking.
Horrified.
Yeah.
Thanks, Steve. From one rogue to rogues around the world. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
And now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the interesting, possibly roguish, number behind it. All right, I'll start with my final bite. It's 4. And I want to help you imagine that if you can't really exchange your currency on international markets, you don't see your currency at the airport to get exchanged for dollars, euros, or Japanese yen. You can't hedge your currency if you're going to ship to, if you're getting imports from another country. You're kind of tied into whatever you can get and perhaps have to use black markets to exchange your currency into one of the larger currencies. And that's what's called a non-convertible currency.
Mm.
That means there are restrictions on your currency and you cannot freely trade it around the world. There's usually an official price. And of course, with an official price on something that's widely traded like a currency, there is a healthy black market behind it. and where you'll get the real exchange rate, usually much, much better than what the official rate is, as my trip to Venezuela taught me a long time ago. So my number is 4 because that's the number of countries in the BRIC, the Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which you would think these are emerging, strong companies. China's definitely
the second largest economy in the world.
But all 4 of these countries with over $2 billion people in population don't have convertible currencies. You can't hedge the Chinese yuan when you ship back and forth and do export and import from there. You can do something that's called a non-deliverable forward, where you don't actually exchange the asset. You just make essentially a bet on the chain, on the change in the price of the currency. So China's probably the biggest example of this. People have to go kind of around the official price, around the official markets, in order to get their business done. And of course, it's one of, the world's leading exporter. And I think I saw they're the leading importer as of 2018 as well. There's a lot of services to get around this, but sometimes not at the official price that China sets for their currency. And that's true that's definitely true for less used currencies like Russia or smaller economies that don't have convertible currencies like South Korea, which doesn't allow its currency to float freely on the markets. So that makes it hard to provide services related to currency because you don't know what price you're going to get. There's not a market. You can't hedge. You can't tie things into it.
Well, I'm going to share my final bite, and it is the current value of the active form of Venezuela's bolivar, known as the Bolivar Soberano, which Steve just informed me means the sovereign bolivar, which is a pretty badass name.
Not a convertible currency.
Not a convertible currency. In case you wanted some, you would need 3,291 of those sovereign bolivars to get to $1. And this currency was actually just introduced last August. It replaces the Bolivar Fuerte, the strong bolivar, which is no more.
Just call me Strong John, by the way, from now on.
You can call me Monica Soberano. And I would love that because I am as bossy as a queen. Anyway, just something to kind of keep in mind in terms of how far Venezuela's economy has fallen.
How far they've fallen, yeah. Great number, Monica. Thank you. My number is 7, and I'll keep it short and sweet. 7 is the number of countries that support, as of this recording in late January, the standing regime of Maduro in Venezuela. And those are, of course, China and Russia, the usual suspects. You have Turkey for some reason. And then you have the other very leftist countries in South America, including Nicaragua, Bolivia, and Cuba.
One authoritarian always loves another.
All right, so that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes, and thanks again for listening.
We'll see you next week.
Bye for now.